The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Psychedelic drugs are being widely touted as the next big thing. Attention is mostly focused on the potential medical uses of psychedelics and psychedelic therapy, but, you know, let's face it, a medicalized system with doctors and state-certified counselors as gatekeepers? That's never going to work. The demand's too great to be satisfied by such a limited and, well, frankly, overpriced system. And not to put too fine a point on it, but mushrooms and other psychedelics are too easily accessible through the illegal market. There'll be no choice but to legalize adult social use. Well, our friends at the Transform Drug Policy Foundation in the UK are preparing for that inevitable future. Their new publication entitled How to Regulate Psychedelics, A Practical Guide, looks at how to shape policy and regulation for psychedelics outside the medical sphere. Transform launched its guide November 14th. Here's Steve Rolls, Senior Policy Analyst at Transform.
One of the things that we tried to do was to look at who is using psychedelics, how are they using psychedelics, and why? What are their motivations for psychedelics? Because we need to know the answers to those questions if we're going to respond with a regulatory framework that deals with the reality of use as we find it. It was actually a surprisingly difficult task because the sort of surveillance data on psychedelics is it's astonishingly. The UN Office on Drugs and Crime compiles data from around the world, and most countries either don't produce any data at all on psychedelics, or psychedelics are lumped in with a broader categorization of hallucinogens, which includes lots of other things, including ketamine and PCP and an array of other drugs often. So it's very difficult to get the kind of granular detail about individual psychedelics or just the classic psychedelics that we're looking at. There is some better data from North America and some European countries. And we were able to find some really good data from sources like the Global Drug Survey, which is an online self-selecting survey of about 100,000 people who use drugs, and they ask, you know, it's a survey done by people who are actually interested in best practice and policy, and they have more granular data, and they ask people about their behaviors and their motivations and so on. So we've used a lot of the Global Drug Survey data in there. Another thing we did, because a basic principle of sound public health policymaking is to identify health risks, and then you target your policy interventions at those risk behaviors, was we have kind of gone through and looked at what the risks associated with psychedelic use are, and what the benefits are as well, because obviously you need to look at both, and drug policy generally, including even alcohol policy, has often neglected to look at benefits of drug use. And if you're not looking at the benefits as well, you're really missing half of the story, and your policy will often be misaligned. So we've tried to look at both sides of that. We then looked at, basically looked at what regulatory tools are available. And again, it's worth being clear that, you know, regulating risky products and behaviors is just one of those things that the governments and do around the world have been doing for generations, for centuries, and in many ways they're very good at it. There's a whole body of regulatory scholarship around regulating risky products, whether it's pharmaceuticals, whether it's alcohol and tobacco, whether it's risky behaviors like driving or dangerous sports or risky products. Regulation of risk is all around us, whether it's in your plug sockets and electronics, whether it's in your fire retardant foam in the chairs you're sitting on. There is an enormous scholarship there. And really, to a significant extent, what Transform's done with this book and a lot of our work historically is just apply that regulatory logic and that regulatory scholarship to a set of products and behaviors that have historically existed outside of regulatory thinking because of the madness of the war on drugs. So it's basically just applying social policy thinking and logic to this novel set of drugs. And psychedelics, non-medical psychedelics in particular, even within the drugs field, even within the drugs regulation reform field, have, as Esther noted, not received a great deal of attention. That's one of the reasons we thought this book was needed. Moving on, monitoring and evaluation. I mean, I think that's self-explanatory. I've already touched on that. I mean, clearly policy needs to be based on evidence, and it needs to be flexible and able to evolve. You know, we need to be able to acknowledge when policy is working, but also when it's not working, and be willing to change. We need to be flexible in a way that obviously prohibition and the war on drugs has singularly failed to be. The next point I want to make was really about getting the balance right, because as I alluded to in terms of the different stakeholders and different priorities, different groups within this debate will have different priorities. Even if we all agree that legalization regulation of some sort is needed, different groups have different priorities. So public health people obviously will prioritize public health, the police will prioritize crime reduction, business interests will prioritize profit, Treasury will prioritize tax revenue, and so on and so forth. And if any one of those groups dominates the discussion, their priorities will shape policy in a different way to if another party dominates. And so it's just really, really important that at this particular juncture, where we have basically a blank slate, and we are, you know, world building, as it were, that all the relevant stakeholders are at the table and they all have their say. But we prioritize the principles and the groups that we feel should be prioritized, that reflect our broader democratically agreed priorities. Now, that will differ between different people, probably on this, even here. I, for example, don't think that we should be prioritizing, and Transform generally doesn't think that we should be prioritizing business interests in terms of, shareholder profits, and that we should be prioritizing social justice and public health and human rights and so on. But there are debates to be had here, and these things need to be thrashed out. There's a balance to be struck between state intervention and personal freedoms. You know, to what extent is state intervention in the private sphere justified? These are really political and philosophical questions. There's no scientific answer to that, but these are things that we need to thrash out. Our general position is that the greater the risk associated with a particular product or behavior, the greater the justification for some form of state intervention. So there is greater state intervention justified with more risky products. It's not too complicated, I don't think. There's obviously a balance to be struck between the need to eliminate the illegal market by making drugs affordable and available versus the need of public health to restrict availability and try and moderate use using regulatory controls on the market. Now, that is quite apparent with something like tobacco tax. You know, public health people saying put it up, the police may be saying put it down, because otherwise you're stimulating the counterfeit market and smuggling and so on. It's perhaps less evident with psychedelics because the illegal market is less extensive than many other groups of drugs and is less associated with social harms. And the public health impacts of psychedelics similarly are relatively less than many other drugs. But still, these delicate balances, these trade-offs, these balancing acts that are intrinsic to all policymaking actually are still present. Perhaps most critically, this issue of profit motivations versus public good. And we'll come back to that, I think, in the discussion on corporate capture. But generally speaking, there is a profound risk that if profit dominates policymaking and regulatory design, other externalities, be it public health or social justice and so environmental issues, can get lost or negated. Moving on to psychedelic risks and benefits and the issues of psychedelic exceptionalism. Looking at psychedelic risks, they are in the most general broad terms, they are really quite unusual. I mean, if you look historically at the psychedelic risks that have dominated the public discourse in terms of the threat of drugs and the war on drugs, to use the sort of stigmatizing terms of the past, you know, death, addiction and madness are kind of the three biggies that have always dominated the discourse. Or, you know, overdose, issues of dependence or substance use disorder, and mental health issues, to use more up-to-date, more appropriate language. But notably with psychedelics, the risks of overdose and dependence are either very low or almost entirely absent. You know, that you really just don't get overdose deaths in the same way you do with most other groups of drugs, perhaps bar cannabis, but certainly things like opioids and stimulants that are often associated with overdose. And the classic sort of substance use disorder, dependence, patterns of compulsive use, whatever language, addiction, whatever language that you choose to use, they just aren't really associated with psychedelics. Sure, there are people who cane loads of psychedelics, and you hear stories about, I took LSD every day for a year and all this sort of thing. But generally, they are not associated with the same sort of patterns of compulsive long-term use. People don't seem to use psychedelics to escape from their lives or as a form of self-medication in the same way that they do with opioids. People don't sort of self-medicate for trauma in the same way. You know, and even NIDA, for example, says that psychedelics, that LSD is not associated with addiction. But that having said that, psychedelics clearly are not entirely risk-free. There are issues around mental health, and I'm not going to go into this. I'm not going to do a sort of depressing list of all the risks of psychedelics, but we do go into it in more detail in the book, so please do look at that. But there are issues around certain mental use of psychedelics with certain mental health vulnerabilities. There are issues around bad trips and negative experiences. These can sometimes continue after initial intoxication has passed, and sometimes can be longer term and distressing. There's a syndrome called HPPD, which is it's rare, but it's certainly a thing. There are issues of harms that can happen whilst you're under the influence, like for, you know, if you're driving, for example. Occasionally there have been issues of suicide or violence. And there are issues around contraindications of using psychedelics with other drugs, certain psychedelics and SSRIs, for example. I'm not going to go into too much detail, but just to say that there are risks and we need to be mindful of them. We need to identify them, and they need to inform our regulatory response in terms of mitigating those risks. Clearly, risks are also, we need to be very careful about making generalizations like saying psychedelics are less risky than XYZ, because clearly the risks to any particular individual are enormously varied depending on their using behaviors, the dosage, the frequency of use, their individual health vulnerabilities, their mental health issues, where they're using, how they're using, are they using with other drugs, and so on. So we just need to be a bit careful about making generalizations. And on that note, I'm going to make a big generalization, which is that generally speaking, the overall risk profile of psychedelics is generally lower than many other drugs or drug groupings, such as alcohol or tobacco or opioids or stimulants. But again, I do caution about this risk of generalizations, and there are risk behaviors, and there are particularly for certain vulnerable individuals associated with psychedelics. But one of the problems with this arguably unique risk profile, this unique risk benefit profile of psychedelics, because we do get a lot of stories about how people benefit from psychedelics, and you know, it brings positive things to their lives, and it can bring positive things to communities. This unusually positive risk benefit balance has sometimes sort of trickled into a sense of psychedelic exceptionalism, that psychedelics are uniquely positive and they are exceptional amongst drugs. And it's a view that's often enhanced by people who have had amazing experiences with psychedelics, that spiritual revelations, personal benefits, it's helped their mental health or whatever it is. And people can sometimes evangelize about their psychedelic use. And often it's people who have access, often quite privileged white people, who have access to political and media capital And there is this creeping sense that somehow psychedelics are different to other drugs and they should be subject to different approaches in policy and law. Our view is, you know, if you're going to ask, are psychedelics a special case? The answer is no. Even though they have their own unique profile and their unique culture, they are drugs like all other drugs. And the logic of decriminalization and the logic of regulation applies to all drugs. In fact, I would go further and say, you know, from a pragmatic public health point of view, it's the drugs that are the most risky, that are probably should be legalized and regulated first. If there is going to be a queue, if we are going to do it first, we should do the ones where there is the biggest public and social benefits to regulation. And given so many of the harms associated with, for example, injected opioid use are associated with prohibition, it kind of makes sense to do those first. Realistically, that's not going to happen. Obviously, to a degree, you know, cannabis is already being legalized first, and there's cannabis exceptionalism is its own thing. It's politically easier, arguably, to legalize and regulate drugs that are seen as less threatening publicly, are perceived as safer. It's probably going to happen anyway. So even if it's not, you know, pragmatically or ethically the right thing to do, it's probably going to happen. In fact, it is already happening that psychedelics is probably going to be the next group of drugs to be legalized and regulated after cannabis. And I just think, given that reality, we need to be mindful and not play into this psychedelic exceptionalism discourse. In fact, we need to challenge it, and we need to use the successes of cannabis and psychedelics regulation to leverage wider reform with regards other drugs.
That was Steve Rolls, senior policy analyst at the Transform Drug Policy Foundation, speaking November 14th at the launch of their new publication entitled How to Regulate Psychedelics, A Practical Guide. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Esther Kintseva is Transform's public affairs and policy manager.
First, I need to open with key principle in any discussions of legally regulating drugs, and in fact, drug reform generally, is that ending the criminalization of people who use drugs is a vital precondition for a meaningful public health and rights-based response. In the guide, we highlight the key principles for the best standard of decriminalization. I direct you there for more detail. A legally regulated market must therefore be accompanied by comprehensive decriminalization. And this principle is what upholds the first model, which we propose, which is private use, including home cultivation, foraging, and not-for-profit sharing. This model exists based on the premise that much psychedelic use exists beyond the realm of formal regulation. And to that end, this model is there to accommodate a large majority of that use. A decriminalized model based on private use and so on would include removing criminal sanctions for foraging, small-scale cultivation of plant-based psychedelics for personal use, as well as small-scale not-for-profit sharing. Of course, the decriminalization principle would also apply for LSD, though we have highlighted specifically plant-based psychedelics around cultivation and foraging, as well as removing criminal sanctions for people who use psychedelics. By removing the sanctions for not-for-profit sharing, This aims to establish an additional, though perhaps more limited, route to access to plant-based psychedelics, in particular, that are beyond our following models that we discuss around social clubs and retail access. Within this, there will be a key aim of any personal use and possession threshold would just be to limit potential sales for profit. And we expect psilocybin mushrooms are likely to make up the majority of cultivation and foraging, although individuals will seek to cultivate other plant-based psychedelics, including DMT-containing plants and cacti for mescaline use. To move on to the not-for-profit association model, we propose this model based on the cannabis social clubs that have been pioneered in Spain. Personal possession and cultivation allowances under a decriminalization model were stretched here to include collective growing and sharing within the clubs. Although this is a relatively new and evolving model, there are several examples of established practices in Spain, Uruguay, Malta, and other jurisdictions The cannabis social club model brings specific benefits to members who have access to legal supply within a community-based environment. Within this, we propose that products supply are limited to plant-based psychedelics, creating a centralized regulatory authority which licenses these associations. Supply is only allowed to association members, and membership numbers should be limited, which is a practice that has been implemented in Malta and Uruguay. Clubs could apply for supervised or guided use licenses, which Steve will get on to describing. And we have also added a provision for granting import licenses where clubs may intend to use ayahuasca under supervised or guided use settings.
That was Esther Kintsova, Public Affairs and Policy Manager at the Transform Drug Policy Foundation. She was speaking at the launch November 14th of Transform's new publication entitled How to Regulate Psychedelics, A Practical Guide. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now, here's Transform's Senior Policy Analyst, Steve Rolls.
The third model is basically a regulated retail model. So I think it's quite similar, really, to what we have, for example, with retail cannabis in some of the provinces in Canada. Perhaps Quebec would be a good example. It's adult-only sales for personal use. It's quality control products, both plant and synthetic. You'd have packing controls. There's an example of some packaging we've mocked up here for magic mushrooms. The packaging, I think you can see it looks quite pharmaceutical. And that's not because we're trying to look like pharmaceuticals. It's just that if you strip back to the basic information and remove branding and marketing, this is kind of what you get. It's just plain with health warnings, basic information, dosage information, name of the product, and you know, if you take away all the marketing and branding information, you basically get something that looks kind of like pharmaceuticals, because that's what pharmaceuticals do as well. Some people think this is a bit churlish and miserable. Our thing was that as soon as you start, and some people have also said when we showed them this, you know, that's going to give people a bad trip if it all looks pharmaceutical. Well, our thing was that if you start to put any design elements on it, you're going to influence people's experience of set and setting and mindset and so on in a different way. So let's just keep it as simple and functional as possible. And of course, when you get these products, you can always take them out and put them in your embroidered, you know, tripper bag or something if you want to. You don't have to leave them in the pharmaceutical packaging. This is a point of sale thing. And we've done packaging for mescaline and LSD pills as well. As Esther's been saying, there's a load more detail on this. This section on regulated retail models is about 30 or 40 pages in the book. It goes into a lot of detail on licensing of vendors, packaging, product controls, a whole bunch of stuff, you know, hours of opening, all of this sort of stuff. We go into a lot more detail. Generally, we think there shouldn't be any marketing or branding. We don't think that these should be conventional commercial products. We've come down fairly hard against the idea of edibles. Generally, it just seems not edibles per se, but particularly edibles that look like sweets. You know, if you really like sweets, just buy some Haribo. Don't put drugs in them. It just seems like it's just a really bad idea. You're just asking for trouble. You know, just no edibles. It just seems like a terrible idea. No. I mean infused edibles that look like attractive children's snacks. It's a terrible idea for obvious reasons. Let's just not go there. It's causing lots of problems with cannabis infused edibles. Let's just not go there with psychedelics. The idea of having, you know, LSD gummies lying around, it's sort of an order of magnitude worse than cannabis infused gummies. So we think that's a really bad idea. We've explored options for whether you could have a state monopoly retail, a bit like they do with alcohol in some of the Scandi countries, a bit like they do with cannabis in Quebec. We're not saying it's an absolute necessity, as we have done with, for example, some regulated stimulants. But it's certainly an option, and in public health terms, quite an attractive one, because it removes some of the commercial incentives for sort of profit-making corporations and some of the problems that that can also bring. The final model is regulated commercial supervised use or guided experiences. So this is the kind of retreat model or guided use model. Obviously, there's going to be lessons learned from traditional and ceremonial use about sort of preparing and respectful use, respecting the power of some of these substances. And we've sort of tried to draw on some of that traditional wisdom and to inform what we've written about this. We think that there is an issue or a duty of care for people who are having guided experiences that really requires properly trained and licensed practitioners administering and supervising this kind of use. And it really does need to take place within an appropriately regulated framework. There are clear risks for people participating in supervised use. There's risks of exploitation. There are safety issues. People need to know that if something goes wrong, that there will be someone there who is trained to look after and support them or provide emergency care if necessary. We need to avoid people making false medical claims and other forms of abuse and exploitation that have unfortunately occasionally been issues with supervised use. The key, obviously, is ensuring the welfare of the participants. And there does need to be accountability and liability for service providers. And I think you do need an institutional framework to oversee these sorts of services if that is to exist and be appropriately enforced. One of the other issues that we've clocked is this idea of screening participants' vulnerabilities. Not everybody should or is appropriate for these sorts of experiences, and we do need to have a screening process so that people who do have certain vulnerabilities get the appropriate warnings and are potentially filtered out.
That was Steve Rolls, senior policy analyst at the Transform Drug Policy Foundation, speaking November 14th at the launch of their new publication entitled How to Regulate Psychedelics, A Practical Guide. Now, you can find that guide, along with a lot of other great resources, at the Transform Drug Policy Foundation website, transformdrugs.org. That's transformdrugs.org. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for Community Radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. Please support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. Find this edition of Century, along with an archive of past shows, at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.